I want to take you back to Paris. It's 1980s. The sun is out and a woman, let's call her Michelle, is strolling along the Champs-Élysées in her acid-wash jeans and big shoulder pads. Her long hair is blowing in the breeze. She's pushing a sleeping baby. The smell of freshly baked croissants is in the air. It's heaven on earth. Michelle decides to pick up her prescription. It's for an appetite suppressant drug called Mediator. She's gained a little bit of weight after the baby and wants to lose it. She's not the only one taking this new drug that was originally designed to help diabetics lose weight. At one time, it's one of the most prescribed drugs in France, with millions of people taking it. Skip forward a year or so, and Michelle's having chest pains. Her doctor sends her in for tests and finds out, to their shock and horror, that she's got heart valve issues. Now, Michelle's one of the lucky ones, because many of the hundreds of other users of Mediator haven't been so lucky. It's estimated to have killed between 500 and 2,000 people over a decade. After more than 10 years of Mediator being sold, the French Ministry of Health eventually swings into action and takes the drug off the market. The drug company, who is called Servier, and France's medical gatekeeper, who is called ANSM, both get investigated. What they find is astonishing. The drug company knew there were serious issues with side effects, yet kept on selling it. Manslaughter and fraud charges against the drug company are proven. The legal system then turns its eye towards the medical gatekeeper, ANSM, and finds that the gatekeeper wasn't being nearly gatekeepery enough. It had been severely compromised by the drug company. Hey there, I'm Bern. I'm a four-time author and I've been published in about 30 countries, I think. When it came time to research for my fifth book, which delved into the world of weight loss drugs, I started to read clinical trials, contacted scientists worldwide and doctors, and obtained information through Freedom of Information. This was about 2 years ago when I started. What I found was pretty startling and, most importantly, wasn't being talked about. And to tell you the truth, I wondered why. I found that the picture surrounding these drugs is like a jigsaw puzzle, and it isn't any junior one. It's reasonably complicated. So today we're going to start with three topics, which form three pieces of the puzzle. We're going to look at obesity worldwide, government regulators, and big pharma, who seemingly have found a solution. I'm also wondering, do these three pieces form the perfect storm? If they do, is it just a little rain shower with a rainbow at the end of the street? Or is it something like a stage 5 cyclone? We just don't know. And possibly it's going to be something in between. It's really anyone's guess. Welcome to Investigating Ozempic. Before I get started on the first of our puzzle pieces, I want to explain to you why I'm doing this podcast. Because to tell you the truth, I've tossed up whether to do it or not. I've been worried about whether I'm going to get sued by Novo Nordisk, but then I sort of think, well, this information is available to the public. You just have to look for it. And I think most people are not looking. But the main reason I want to do it is because women are 75% of the users of these drugs. They are also the ones that, according to the FDA, suffer the most from side effects. I believe the ratio is 2 to 1. And I think if women know this information, they will possibly look at these drugs in another light and possibly talk to their doctors and maybe even use them in a different manner. Three questions that I want to answer in this podcast is, what are these drugs? How are we using these drugs? And why are we using them like that? That's really what I want to get to. So I just want to be really honest with you. I'm not a medical doctor, and none of this information should be construed as medical advice. Please read the show notes for the full medical disclaimer. Thanks. Most weeks I'm going to have a guest on. They're going to be talking about their experience and how it's impacted their lives.
The very first jab, I'd sort of decided, look, I already feel like crap. My health is a dumpster fire. So I thought I might need, you know, every anti-nausea product and anti-diarrheal product and anti-constipation product. And I had this arsenal, like a pharmacopoeia of side effects, things ready to go, and didn't need any of them. So I almost noticed with the very first jab is the food noise. It was like someone hit the mute button.
That's Laurie, and we'll be hearing more from her in another episode. For today, I really need to get some of the groundwork out of the way in order for you to understand how this picture all comes together. You're going to need to understand a few basic things. So I'm going to get started with those first off. And the first thing is Ozempic and Wegovy are the same drug. They're a semaglutide or a GLP-1. A GLP-1 is a glucagon-like peptide 1. The difference between the two of them is that Ozempic is prescribed for diabetes and Wegovy is prescribed for weight loss. Wegovy is typically in a much higher dosage. The other thing you're going to need to understand is that both of those drugs are manufactured by Novo Nordisk. Novo Nordisk is a Danish company, and they are the biggest company in Europe, the most powerful. They are also bigger than the Danish economy. They are worth that much money. In Australia and the US, Ozempic is approved for use to improve blood glucose levels in adults that have type 2 diabetes. Wegovy is approved for use alongside diet and exercise for people with a body mass index, a BMI, of 30 or greater, or 27 or greater, who suffer from other conditions, such as high blood pressure. It's fairly common practice for doctors to prescribe drugs off-label. Off-label means when they use them for a different purpose. So that's why you see Ozempic, which is a diabetes drug, often prescribed for weight loss. It's using it off-label. Novo Nordisk can't make Ozempic or Wegovy fast enough. The demand far exceeds what they can supply. In Australia, as early as 2022, and still going right now till the end of 2024, demand for both of those drugs is sky high. In particular, demand for the starter low-dose versions. The advice to GPs in Australia is to not initiate new patients on Ozempic, that is for weight loss. And the recent advice is to change those who are using Ozempic for weight loss to Wegovy. The big problem is that the diabetics who really need to use Ozempic can't obtain the drug. So in answer to this, Novo Nordisk are spending $30 billion to build factories. They currently have sites in 9 countries. The reason for Novo Nordisk's amazing success story are basically Ozempic and Wegovy. These are two blockbuster drugs. A blockbuster drug is one that earns over $1 billion per year, and it's every pharmaceutical company's wet dream. So I'm going to be interviewing a few people on this podcast about their experiences with semaglutides and other weight loss drugs. I'm generally not going to be asking them which drug they take unless they want to volunteer it, because there is a judgment. There is a judgment for those people who are taking Ozempic for weight loss. because of the shortage of the drug, there are many people that believe that taking Ozempic is literally taking it out of the hands of the diabetics who do need these drugs. I won't be making any judgment here on this podcast about people who are using Ozempic for weight loss. I figure that's up to them and their doctor and their own personal circumstances. So, yep, no judgments here. So now that we understand a little bit of the background and a little bit about Ozempic and Wegovy, we're going to get stuck into the first puzzle piece. So why do we need these drugs? It's pretty clear we've got a problem being overweight or having obesity in the developed world. Some people call it an obesity epidemic. Now, in terms of the English-speaking developed countries, the USA is the heaviest, with the biggest problem at nearly 71% of their population either overweight or obese. Australia comes in second at 66%. Canada and New Zealand are both at 65%, and the United Kingdom is at 64%. These numbers continue to climb every year. Now, the dollar impact of us all being overweight is expected to be huge. For our governments, it's supposed to be, in the USA, $173 billion a year. That's what it will cost that economy. In Australia, it's $11.8 billion. Those numbers are according to Bupa. In the UK, it's £100 billion, and in Canada, it's $7.1 billion. These are mind-blowing numbers. So, we've now got these new drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, and they really vary in cost. In the USA, which is the largest market for these weight loss drugs, the cost of Ozempic per month, even though you use these drugs weekly, you usually get a prescription per month, the cost per month is US$936. The cost of Wegovy is $1,349. It's nearly $400 more than Ozempic. In Australia, the cost is US$87 for Ozempic and between $175 and $310 for Wegovy. In Aussie dollars, that's $150 for Ozempic and between $260 and $460 for Wegovy. In the UK, in US dollars, it's $93 for Ozempic and for Wegovy, it's between $219 and $388. In Canada, the cost is in US dollars, $159 for Ozempic and $310 for Wegovy. New Zealand at the moment doesn't have either of those drugs, and that's due to the global shortage. So as you can see, these drugs are really expensive. And as you probably noticed when I said all those figures, Wegovy is always more expensive than Ozempic. We're paying an awful lot of money for our weight loss drugs. Now, I'm not sure if you've heard Bernie Sanders. He's a senator from the US. He's been on a crusade lately. He's been trying to get the cost of Ozempic and Wegovy lowered in the USA. Here's what he had to say.
We basically want to know why he is charging the American people 10 or 15 times more for the same exact product that he's charging people in Europe, Canada, and elsewhere. And I think basically, he may say it or not, the answer is he can do it in the United States because he can get away with it.
Obesity is very much a political issue. Governments worldwide set up programs that only get disintegrated by the next government that comes along. They try to deal with the health issues of their country, often unsuccessfully. Now, the reason they do this is because, according to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, excess weight, especially obesity, it's a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, sleep apnea, psychological issues, some musculoskeletal conditions, and some cancers. And as your weight increases, so does the risk of developing these conditions. In addition, being overweight can hamper the ability to control or manage chronic diseases. People who are overweight or obese also have higher rates of death. It's a very big problem. If we didn't have all of the diseases associated with being overweight or obese, it wouldn't be an issue. But it would probably still be a bit of an issue in terms of psychologically, because women are, you know, strongly encouraged to be thin, thin, thin. But in terms of diseases, it wouldn't cause such a problem with mortality. I think many of us know that there are an enormous amount of psychological issues that come along with being heavier or overweight in our society. As a larger woman, I've felt that myself, and I will be talking to many of my guests in regard to that issue. So I don't want to seem like I'm glossing over that, because I'm absolutely not. Have you heard the term an obesocentric society? I started hearing that term when I started discussing this with doctors and professors in the health world. What it is, it's a society that encourages you to stay fat. It is one that contains a lot of fast food outlets. It contains supermarkets that carry up to 60% processed foods. It's one that encourages you to drive rather than walk, but it possibly doesn't have a lot of parks, so it doesn't encourage outdoor activity. It basically is encouraging you to stay fat. So we've looked at the first puzzle piece, which is the problem. We've got a really big fat problem, to put it really bluntly. The second puzzle piece is that we've got drug companies saying, hey, we've got a solution. That's the second puzzle piece. Morgan Stanley Research has reevaluated the global market for obesity drugs and is now expecting it to reach $105 billion in 2030. This is up from an earlier forecast of $77 billion. So you can see these weight loss drugs are going to make pharmaceutical companies an awful lot of money. Now, at the moment, there are two main competitors in that market. One of them is Eli Lilly, and they're a US-based company. And the second one is Novo Nordisk, a Danish company. Novo Nordisk are the ones that make and distribute Ozempic and Wegovy. By the mid-2030s, most of Novo Nordisk's patents will expire, and it will be free for other drug companies to put out their own weight loss drugs that are very similar, and it will drive the price down. And there are literally dozens of new weight loss drugs being developed and tested as we speak. As I said earlier, North America is their largest market by far. When you look at their annual report, the North American market is the largest. The other market that is just opening up for them is China. China has just approved Wegovy. That is said to be one of the biggest markets. I'm not sure if it's going to be bigger than the US. It's really a wait and see. But in China, the patent runs out in 2 years. And according to clinical trial records, there are at least another 15 similar drugs in development in that country. It's basically a race to make as much money as fast as possible in that economy while they hold the trump cards. The number of adults who are overweight or obese in China is projected to reach 540 million overweight and 150 million obese by 2030. This is according to a 2020 study by Chinese public health researchers. So you can see the possibility of an awful lot of money made in that country as well. So I'm sure you're getting the idea. I'm trying to show you that this is all about the money. And here we come to the third puzzle piece of the day, the regulators. How do you think a drug gets on the shelves in a country? Well, I'll tell you. It has to go through a government regulator. Every country in the world has regulators. For the USA, it's the FDA. For Australia, it's Australia's Therapeutic Goods. For Europe, it's European Medicines Agency. And for UK, it's the MHRA. Now, some of these bodies work together, but many don't. The new drug applications come in from the drug companies. So Often when they are evaluating drugs or processing new drug applications, they are looking at different issues. For example, the TGA, when they were looking at semaglutides, they were looking at the delivery device, which is the injectable pen that that drug comes in. Whereas the MHRA and the FDA were more focused on the lack of diversity in the clinical trials. Lack of diversity means that usually a clinical trial should show a good cross-section of society, various age groups, various ethnicities, but that didn't seem to happen in a lot of the clinical trials that they were looking at for Ozempic and Wegovy. So they questioned it. Now, have a guess how the majority of these bodies are funded. Keep that guess in your head for a minute. Just think about it. And yep, that's right. Through payments from drug companies. So government regulators are primarily funded through fees and charges that they receive from the drug companies. Now, to me, that feels like a conflict of interest. The FDA is about 75% funded. That's according to a New York Times article. Australia's therapeutic goods is about 93% funded. That's according to AusBiotech. European Medicines Agency is approximately 87% funded. That's according to them. I've got some problems with this setup because I think that seems like a conflict of interest. If you're receiving money from a drug company and then you having to look at their drugs and approve them, I would imagine that there's some sort of pressure to approve their drugs. I would like to know if the TGA is performing as it should to ensure protection of public health. I want to know that they're actually protecting me. And the total dependence of them on the drug industry for its funding seems a compromise. The two main consequences that I see of this are the risk of bias in evaluating their reports and possibly the issue of a revolving door. A revolving door issue is when you get TGA employees who are possibly hoping for a job in a big paying pharmaceutical company. It does happen that government employees do go to work for large drug companies. That doesn't necessarily mean that anything corrupt has gone on, but it's a concern. Now, there's a couple of people that I want to talk about. In the FDA, there was a guy called Dr. Lay. He was head of the FDA a long time ago, but he was critical of the setup. And he said that he had constant, tremendous, sometimes unmerciful pressure from the drug industry, and that the drug company lobbyists, combined with the politicians who worked on behalf of their patrons, could bring tremendous pressure to bear on him and his staff to try preventing FDA restrictions on their drugs. So it's not just approving them, but it's the restrictions that these government regulators put on drugs as well. Lay stated that the entire issue was about money, pure and simple. This was from an interview with him after he left his position as commissioner of the FDA. Now, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Marcia Engel, has stated that it's time to take the Food and Drug Administration back from the drug companies. In effect, the User Fee Act puts the FDA on the payroll of the industry it regulates. One of the issues with the FDA, which is a little different to the TGA, is that in 1992, Congress passed the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. Boiling that down to the basics, the law enables the FDA to collect large user fees from pharmaceutical companies or device manufacturers seeking approval for a new drug or medical device. The catch is that the ability to collect those fees depends in part on the FDA's speed in completing the new drug approval process. Now, I'm pretty sure that drug companies would like their drugs approved speedily, but the language of the law is relatively vague on the speed front. But the fees helped increase staffing, which I think is a good thing. I mean, you can always use more staff in government bodies. I'm sure the FDA could always do with more staff, and that would reportedly cut drug approval times by half. The fees are not insignificant, The expected fee intake to the FDA was nearly $300 million in 2007, but in 2023, it is expected to be $3 billion. How does this link back to Novo Nordisk? Well, it doesn't in any clear-cut smoking gun manner. But I want you to be very aware of who approved these drugs in your country and the possible compromises that there are, because we'll be coming back to these regulators again and again. A perfect storm of events is when circumstances all come together at once. We've got a few things that we've never had before. We've never had before a hugely sick and obese society. We've never had before a drug company with an expensive, revolutionary new weight loss drug. We've also never had before government regulators who are so in the pocket of drug companies. I'm wondering, is this combination the perfect storm? The thing is, at the moment, we just don't know. Next time on the podcast. Back in 2005, Lars Sørensen, the ex-CEO of Novo Nordisk, said in a statement that obesity is primarily a social and cultural problem. It should be solved by means of a radical restructuring of society. There is no business for Novo Nordisk in that area. These were strong words, yet clearly he changed his mind sometime before he accepted his US $10.7 million golden handshake and went on to chair the Novo Nordisk Foundation. Plus, we continue to follow the money and take a good look at the Novo Nordisk share price and its meteoric rise. We look at how it's made multiple millionaires of board members. See you next week on Investigating Ozempic. Please don't forget to rate, follow, and subscribe. Investigating Ozempic was written and produced by Bernadette Fisher. Please see links in the show notes.